Okay, I am here with Mr. Wei in the Civil Service Agency. And just to confirm for the tape that you have agreed to consent to
Yes,
listen
I've
to.
Agreed to do that.
Okay. Could we start just briefly speaking a little bit about your role here in the Civil Service Agency and in particular the reforms that you've been involved in, the civil service reforms?
Okay, I'm the Deputy Director General for Administration, and my role has we are carrying on the reform. I'm supervising the biometric program. I also supervise the selection of employees through giving examinations to those who are entering for the first time to the civil service, and I'm also responsible for internal corporate services, such as supervising the power, supervising the general staff internally.
And could you speak a little bit about sort of thinking back to the earliest days of your work here, how the people that you count on for support in the programs that you run, the reforms that you are behind? Who are the people that you count on to push the reforms through?
What you mean internally, within the agency also,
both
or
internally
outside?
And outside?
The first thing is that in order for the reform to take place, you have to have the political will.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about depending on who, first of all, depend on the ministers in government, the president, and those in authority that are able to help the reform to take place. Because the reform is not just a civil service agency, but it's a civil service reform, and which takes you up to the various ministries and agencies of government. There must be some reception on the part of the ministers or the deputy ministers and personnel director and human resource officers in order for you to do the work. So we rely on those people for information. We rely on them for support in terms of whatever, if there's need for training, for them to identify the training needs and so on and so forth.
Could we speak maybe first about the biometric reforms? Go through, talk about each reform and kind of the process by which it became implemented.
Yes.
What were, for the biometric reform in particular, could you think about beginning, what was the coalition of people outside the agency that you were able to get behind it?
The first thing is that we took over the government when it was bloated with ghost workers, and we had about 49,000 or 50,000 employees on the payroll, and the bulk of them were not actually regular employees, but instead some of them were ghost workers. Some have died during the war and their names were still on the payroll. Some had gone to the States and other places in diaspora, and yet their names are on the payroll. Some are working with NGOs, and their names are still on the payroll. So in order to clean the payroll, we decided to launch the biometric program. But again, it's difficult for us to do it because most of the employees, the civil servants, are based in the rural areas. And it is difficult to reach to some of the areas. They are inaccessible. It's not easy to get up a car or so, especially during the rainy season. It is just difficult. So, in order for us to start, we had to communicate. We had to educate those who are supposed to take part in the biometric program, the employees, and that has been going on. We gave out a contract to some foreign firm to do it, and we have started. We have distributed the phone to ministries and agencies and those who are closer and those who are the population smaller. We dealing with them first. For Ministry of Education and Internal Affairs, Ministry of Education alone is about 10,000 persons on the payroll, and they are based in the interior, in the rural areas. So those ones are hard to reach, so we have to take time to deal with them after the rainy season.
Thinking back to the time when the biometric reform began, there must have been many competing priorities for reforms. How did this one, what made it seem like the time was ripe for this?
Yes, there are a whole lot of issues in a reform. For example, we have the issue of decentralization, where most of the work is centralized in Monrovia, and whereby we have a lot of employees in the interior. And again, if you go into decentralization, there are some legal issues that are involved. For example, if you're going to decentralize, for example, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the work of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, there are some legal issues. If the superintendent or the county district officers have to be elected by the people in the counties, you have to go and repeat the law, the statute that says that the president should appoint the district officer or the superintendent. If you have to say that since the services are decentralized, and for example, if taxes are collected in a county, the taxes should remain in a county for county development, you have to go back to repeal the law that says that all taxes collected should be sent to the Minister of Finance. Mm. So these are some legal issues that have to be addressed. Mm. Beyond that, We have restructuring and issue, redefining the functions and mandates of ministries and agencies. There are some ministries and agencies that have some overlapping functions. For example, you have the Ministry of Public Works, and you also have a Ministry of Rural Development. If you look at their functions, you see that Ministry of Rural Development is performing similar functions as that of the Ministry of Road of Public Works. They do federal construction, they do grading and so on and so forth, and the Ministry of Public Works does the same thing. The Ministry of Road Development also carries out some water and sanitation. They dig wells in the interior, and the Ministry of Public Works is also doing similar thing. So the reform, we have to redefine the functions and mandates of ministries and agencies to see if there are some overlapping functions, if those things can be straightened up. And if you do that, there are also some problems that are involved, some challenges involved. If you redefine the role of a ministry and it takes on a new role, new functions, new mandates, maybe the new mandates or functions will require smaller staffing instead of the huge staff or bureaucracy that they have. Mm-hmm. Take, for example, the Ministry of Agriculture. If you redefine their function, you will realize that the work of the Ministry of Agriculture is actually based in the rural area. They are supposed to see about food production and so on and so forth. But they are doing that, and they are also responsible for policy making. So will their new function be concentrated only on policy issue, and then maybe the production aspect be transferred to maybe another agency or maybe a private entity or so? Those are issues that need to be addressed in the reform.
So how do, among those issues, how was the choice made to focus, among other things, on the biometric reform?
As I said, the biometric is something that we just started. We haven't gone in depth. We haven't taken photos. We haven't actually gone into the details, such as going to the counties or even going from ministry to ministry to take photos and take fingerprints and so on and so forth. Is still in its infancy. What we have done now is that we have printed the forms and distributed. We are hoping that when we go into full operation, for example, if you take on the Ministry of Agriculture, we'll be able to identify exactly who are the employees of the Ministry of Agriculture. If they have any ghost workers will be able to tell whether they are ghost workers or not. We will be able to tell if there are some people if there are names on their payroll that the people do not actually exist, we'll be able to identify that. We'll be able to tell those who have reached to the age of 65 that should be pensioned and they are still on a payroll. We'll be able to tell those, according to our law, if you reach the age of 65, you should be retired. If you serve for 25 years or more, you should be pensioned. And based on those records, mm-hmm. we'll be able to tell who is ready to be pensioned, who is ready to be retired, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Who should need some training based on the assessment, who should need some training, and so on and so forth.
Which departments, so the Civil Service Agency is, when you go into a department like the Agriculture Department, the Civil Service Agency goes in and does these assessments.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yes.
What departments have you done that for already?
For needs assessment.
Mm. For this process you're talking about, of thinking about whether the department has...
No, as I said, we have already distributed the forms.
Yeah.
To various ministries. There are just few ministries that we haven't reached yet.
Okay.
Looking at the volume of work that they have and number of employees that they have. For example, the Ministry of Agriculture,
mm.
and Ministry of Education.
Mm.
Education has about 10,000, between 9,000 to 10,000 persons on the payroll. There are huge number of teachers in a rural area. The Ministry of Health, for example, has huge number of nurses and doctors mm. in the interior. So we haven't reached to them. But with a smaller number, like for example, or agriculture and some other ministries that have small number of employees, we have distributed forms to them.
Mm.
And when we collect the forms, then we'll be able to identify and be able to carry on the operation, as I said.
Right. What do you think are some of the challenges to that? I mean, when you go into an agency that has all of these, that is a little bit bloated or has some ghost workers, there must be some sort of pushback from the ministries themselves. What are some of the challenges to that work?
There are a lot of challenges, huge challenges. The first thing is that we have capacity problem in the country.
Yeah.
As a result of the civil service, as a result of the civil war, rather, mm-hmm. A lot of those who were trained prior to the war were either killed, and some of them went to exile and they haven't returned. And some of them, as I said, they are working with NGOs and so forth. Now, in order to attract qualified people into the civil service, there must be good remuneration package for them that will be able to attract and retain them.
Hmm.
And that is not possible. That is not existing for now. Because of the current budget.
Hmm.
The budget cannot really pay, cannot do those things that we're supposed to do, like paying salary as compared to other countries around us. That is a great challenge. Their income is low. Institutions or maybe or some companies that will come in, like for example, quite recently they said that there's a metal steel company that's able to come in. It has slowed down its operation because of the global financial problem, and that also affects government's intake. So these are challenges.
Yeah.
In order to send somebody out of the country for training, or maybe at a higher level, You need to have money to do it. That is also a challenge.
What is the reform you would consider your greatest success, or the agency's greatest success while you've been here working as part of the leadership team?
To some extent, since we started with the payroll, I think between 2007 and 2008. There were some 17,000 unclaimed checks
mm.
that people could not come to identify that it is theirs.
Mm.
And that was reported to government. And that, I think, is a success. the payroll has been reduced from 50,000 to about 34,000 right now as we speak. The payroll is now like 34,000 persons.
Mm.
That is a plus. And also because of the capacity problem as I talk about, government was able to get some support from the international community, and we launched what we call the senior executive service program, where we employ about 100 persons, and they are being supported by the World Bank, UNDP, the government of the United States of America, the government of the Federal Republic of Germany, Greece, Sweden, Humanity United, and so on and so forth. They are supporting that program. Besides that, we also have another program called the Transfer of Knowledge through Expatriate Nationals, TOC-10.
TOC-10, right.
The TOC-10 program, people that came from other parts of the world, from the diaspora. They are Liberians, and they are being deployed in ministries and agencies to strengthen their capacities. Like, for example, at the JFK Medical Center, we employ some medical doctors. They are Liberians. They are employed, and they are working. They came through the TOC-10 program. If you went to the Ministry of Education, the director of higher education, for example, is on the TOC-10 program, and they are being brought in to strengthen the capacity of government. So I take those to be a plus.
Could we talk a little bit about the SES program, the Senior Executive Service?
Yes.
In the beginning of that, when you think about a civil service that exists and then starting to bring people in who have not been in the civil service from overseas. What are some of the challenges to both bringing them into the civil service, integrating them, and making people who are already in the civil service sort of comfortable with them coming in?
That is also another challenge. But if you look at the structure, if you look at for example those that were recruited, more than 50%, in fact, I would say 90% of those who were recruited locally. Yes.
I didn't know that.
Yes. 90% recruited locally and 10% from outside. So, it's true that if you have someone coming from abroad, maybe, and coming to do similar job that you are doing, maybe at an advanced level or so, sometimes people feel insecure, or sometimes they feel that, oh, this person has come to take over my job, and that kind of phobia is there. But the understanding is that those who are coming are coming with expertise, are coming with experiences that they will be able to share, that they will be able to transfer their knowledge. And so Before they come in, the ministries or agencies that are supposed to absorb them have been educated to the extent that they should know that these are Liberians. This is their home. They have their experiences outside. They've been working in other places. They need to come to help our country. And so they have been informed. The employees have been educated to the extent that they know. And another challenge that is there is that those who are coming in, SES personnel or professionals, make higher salary than those that are on the ground. That is another issue.
To attract them to come back.
In order for you to attract them to come, you have to offer them better salaries. And that is another issue.
How do you deal with that? Is there any kind of campaign with among the civil service to educate people?
No, it is not so. That is not so. As a matter of fact, the SES program was open to everyone. Even if you are in the civil service already, and you feel that you can apply and you can get into it, fine. If you go through the interview and you're successful, okay, you get into it, you can be employed. As a result, there were some people who were in the civil service before they applied and they were employed into the SES program. So it was opened. It was open to everyone, and that was competitive. It's based on merit, so it's not a matter of whether you're here or if you feel that you are capable of doing it, fine, you apply.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Were there officials either in the president's office or in the legislature that had to be that you had to get behind these programs to get them passed?
No, not actually. It is the executive's program. It was not something that we had to go to seek legislative approval before we can go into operation. It wasn't so. It is the executive's program. The executive runs the ministries and agencies. The ministries fall under the executive branch. The executive saw that it was appropriate and needed. The need was there for capacity building. The need was there for strengthening the capacities of ministries and agencies, and it needed Liberians to do that. And the president asked for it, and how it is being done.
So it was the president that had to be
convinced. Yes, of course, you were convinced on that.
What about for the biometric identification program? Did that require legislative support or other support from other parts of the government?
No, not actually. No. No.
So it was, again sort of convincing the president.
Yes. Even the legislators themselves know that there are some ghost names on payroll and how to get it. They ask, how are you going to do it? How are you going to get rid of the ghost names? What program have you put in place? That's a question they ask us. So it's something that they know that we have to do. How are you going to do this one? How will you get the ghost names off the payroll? How will you do that?
Yeah.
We need to know.
Yeah.
And so
when you go about starting a program like that, what is the process to get the approval inside the executive? Do you go and meet with the vice president or with the chief of staff? Or what is the process by which people are sort of convinced?
Well, usually when a program like this, and when we started, first of all, we had to launch the program, the reform program, and we had to build a consensus from civil society groups, from donors coming in, international partners, and when the consensus was built, and the draft of the comprehensive civil service reform strategy document was done, that was taken to the cabinet for cabinet's approval. And they deliberated on that, and that was approved by the cabinet before we could go into the operation. And within the comprehensive document that I'm speaking to, we have the biometric program in it.
Okay.
We have gender issue in there. We have the restructuring and right sizing issue featured in there. We have qualitative service delivery issue featured in there also.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that was presented to the cabinet.
Could we talk a little more in detail about how the comprehensive civil service reform the plan how that was passed? How did you go about interacting with the other cabinet members who had to be sort of convinced to go along? Was there what was the process beginning?
We had a workshop where they were invited, and many people came and presented papers and expressed their own ideas how they think the comprehensive civil service reform strategy should go. What was the strategic direction from their ends, and so on and so forth. People came and made presentations, and institutions made presentations. Civil society groups came and made presentations, and how they saw that their role would be, how they fit into it, and so on and so forth.
What kinds of civil society groups did you invite?
We invited the Civil Service Association. We invited the Legal Bar Association. We invited that's a long time now, so
fair enough.
Several others.
What initiated the beginning of this process? Was this internal to your agency, or was the did the president say we need a comprehensive plan?
Well, the issue is one of the four pillars of the government.
Mm.
That there should be a better service delivery.
Mm.
And how will you have a better service delivery?
Mm.
And that came on flow. And the Civil Service Agency Director General had to take into consideration if there should be better service delivery in the country. Look at the issues that are involved, look at pay and grading, look at how people are being selected into the civil service, look at the payroll itself and review the payroll and see whether it is the actual one, and look at issues like pension and so on and so forth. And all those he had to take into consideration. He had a call meeting, he had to build a consensus among the people, among the employees, among civil society group and others, in order to come up with the draft and present it to the president.
And when was this? Was this right at the beginning of the administration?
That button, it started from 2007. Yeah, I think.
And so what happened before that? After the election, the four pillars of government that began. When did that begin?
It started as soon as the president was inaugurated.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so
in 2006.
Beginning. Yeah. Right. And so a year later, we began the process of the civil service reform.
Yes.
What is being done to kind of keep the civil society organizations and the cabinet informed and involved so that they understand and still support what the agency is doing?
We have, when you were entering, you saw maybe you didn't look keenly. There's a room downstairs, office downstairs, called the Civil Service Reform Directorate, and that office is responsible to coordinate the civil service reform programs. It is responsible to inform ministries and agencies about the happening, about the development of the reform. It is also responsible to coordinate the activities of internal reform. We have already established internal reforms in ministries and agencies of government, so that the reform, if for example, it will go to Ministry of Youth and Sports, they should have their own meetings, and you have how the reform should go, and this and that, and so on and so forth. We have an office that is liaising with these ministries and agencies, with the ministers, to address them on a weekly or monthly basis, how the reform process is going. And that office has been established. We have a director who is responsible for that.
And I don't know whether this is important, but was it important to build popular support for the civil service reforms, to communicate to the people what was going on, that this reform process was ongoing to improve service delivery?
Well, people were involved. It was not something that it was difficult to do. These are issues that were glaring. Like, for example, when it comes to the issue of low salary, it's something that is just everywhere people know about. When it comes to ghost names on payroll, is something that many people know about. It was 19 that you had to really struggle to get people to support. No.
Right. Could you talk a little bit more about the work? I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about the workshops and how they were organized.
Which workshop?
The workshop for the reform plan that you're speaking about. With the civil service and with the international partners and with the agencies.
Okay. Well, anyway, as I said, when we started, we invited international partners, we invited civil society groups, we invited civil servants, and we invited ministers in to the workshop. And in fact, the president herself was present at the opening, mm. and she presided the workshop I'm talking about.
Yeah,
she was there for the whole day.
Mm.
She presided.
Wow.
That shows her support
yeah.
to the program. Her yeah. presence was not just something that she was making speeches, but she was a presided, listening to presentations from ministries and agencies, from international organizations, and so on and so forth, from even so civil society groups and so on and so forth. So when we, to start, we had to invite people to come and speakers to present papers. And at the end of the day, we sort of went into the deliberations, went into their papers, and tried to
internally.
Yes.
Yeah.
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 Put together, and then after about 3-4 months, we called them to vet the paper, the strategy document, and review it and vet it, and after that, it was sent to the cabinet for approval.
Mm. And what was that process like in the internal meetings in those 3 or 4 months? How were different constituencies weighed? How did you incorporate the feedback from the various groups?
Well, that again was not a major problem because we ourselves were part of the process.
Right.
We ourselves were chairing the meetings and
yeah.
whatever discussions went on. We
yeah.
knew the direction.
Yeah.
We were also guarding during the directions and so on and so forth. There were also some consultants that came into the process that will help to guide people who have had experiences with best practices were invited to share their experiences. And for the internal work, that was also done by consultants. We are consultants who are to put the paper together.
Mm.
You know, sample views and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Could we talk a little bit about how you've been here since 2005? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes.
A bit longer than that. I came in before. I was serving as a technician before.
During the transitional
yes.
government.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So after her inauguration, I'm interested in speaking a little bit about how you pulled an office together to be successful to carry out the reform. In many parts of the world, it's a great challenge to get the people in your office and in the agency together to get the job done. What were some of the challenges to that, and how did
the first thing is that the Director General is one who had worked here for many years in the 80s. And he worked here, and he even sent abroad to get his master's degree.
Mm.
He returned, he worked here before going abroad for his PhD. And he knows the job. He'd been here, he had experiences, he knows the job. So it's something that it was not new. And when he came in to organize and reorganize and do all those stuff was something that he knew very well.
Yeah.
Like for some of us too, like for me, I started work here in 1997.
Mm.
And so I have worked here for some long time before I was appointed by the president.
Yeah.
And so I'm aware of the work, and I worked here as a technician, and I know most of what we do here.
Yeah.
So it was not, so for us to organize, it was not a difficult problem.
Mm. So it was most of the staff in the
yes.
agency were there during the during the transition.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. And how in the beginning of the transition, how did you identify kind of the talents that you needed to find and the kinds of people you needed to find? That must have been difficult in the beginning to find the right people to bring in.
Well, Most of the real technical work have been given out to consultants. Most of it will give it out to consultants. It is because of the capacity problem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have been given to consultants. Like for example, the pay and grading has been given to consultants. The pension review has been given to a consultant. The SES program to set it up, to put together,
right,
has been given to consultants, and so on and so forth.
So are there efforts to bring those now,
Yeah.
to bring those back in?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what are those efforts like? What are the challenges to that work?
Well, the first thing is to secure funding in the first place, to secure funding, to
Right.
get some funding from donors, and so in order for the work to be done was a challenge. To get even to get it, the capacity built here was a big problem,
Yeah.
and we had to appeal to the UK Department of International Development, DFID,
Yeah.
to come in. That's why you see our computers and so on stuff.
Yeah.
Because here was totally, I would say the whole building was some. It was so much dilapidated. We are going to build, first of all, to build the capacity of the institution before we could go into the work. So that was a big challenge for us.
What strategies do you use to build the capacities of the staff that you do have over time?
Yes, we when for example, when we got computers and from donors, we started training our own people in-house. We have a lab, computer lab, where we do computer training. We hire someone who will come in to train the employees so that they will be able to cope with the work that we have to do. In the past, people were dealing with papers, heap of papers here and there. When you check our record room, you have a whole lot of papers. But now we're trying to see if we can get into a computer to put them on computer and store them in that way. So to answer your question, we had to first of all build the capacity of those who are within to be able to understand a job and do it right.
What about the technical capacities beyond that to do the civil service reform work?
Yes. In order for the reform work to actually take place, that's why in order for it to actually take place in order for it to succeed, that's why we deployed the senior executive service personnel professionals into the system and the top 10 professionals into the system. That's one aspect. And in some ministries and agencies, the Institute of Liberia Institute of Public Administration is carrying out training, identifying training needs at ministries and agencies, and is carrying out training.
Which ministry is that part of?
That's our IPA,
Okay.
yeah, the Institute of Public Administration.
Oh, right.
That is doing that. Yeah.
Did you take any steps to ensure that sort of your team was dedicated to the mission? Was there any need to employ any sort of special incentives or management techniques to get people working hard for the mission, for the reform effort?
Well, in order to do that, government has introduced a sort of incentive to help encourage, to help boost the morale of employees to be able to carry on a reform. And that is to give general allowance to employees. Not all employees though. That is tied to functions. It's tied to functions. For example, those who serve for longer hours in the offices, as compared to regular employees, they get some kind of allowance given to them. If you came to work today, if you came to work and you serve, the regular working hours for us is from 8 o'clock to 4 o'clock.
Mm.
But though there are some who work beyond that,
mm.
and the government is compensating to do that, and that is to help the reform process to move forward.
Leaders in many countries face pressure to provide jobs to important people or family members or difficult factions in the country. Have there been pressure in the civil service agency, or have you encountered this in the more general civil service reforms?
No. That was the case during the interim period.
Right.
That was the case before the government took over. That is what caused the overstaffing of employees in the civil service. Prior to the sitting of this government, some of the warlords would take anyone, maybe their family members, maybe those who served them as the during the time of the war.
Mm.
If, for example, you have you have a minister who was a warlord or so, he had people who were serving him, he had people who were his bodyguards and so on and so forth.
Right.
And he took them to the Minister of Finance and just placed them on the payroll without any regard for civil service procedures.
Mm.
Whether the person was even a high school graduate or not, he went there and just put him on the payroll. That was the kind of situation that we experienced during the interim period.
Mm.
But it's no longer like that.
Yeah. So, how did your agency go about that in the first year and a half of the new administration? Go about reversing that.
Well, the issue is that the agency is not in the business of dismissing people to say, oh well, you were brought by social person, so you are dismissed. No, we don't do that. Those who need to be trained. Being identified to be trained so that they will be able to cope with the job situation. Those who, for example, if those who fall in grade one, and...
Is that the lowest grade?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the lowest grade. If your position is in grade one, but your salary is in grade 10, it happened. And those are issues that we're battling with now.
Mm-hmm.
If you are in grade one and we find out that your salary is in grade 10,
yeah.
because a warlord carry you and just put you and give you any kind of salary,
yeah.
we are not dismissing or we are not bringing you down to grade one level. But when there's an increment, when there's a general increment, you don't benefit.
Mm-hmm.
You remain in that grade. You mm-hmm. remain where you are. And that's the kind of situation that how we try to address the issue.
Right.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. Are there other things like that that you do? I mean, there must be salary issues and people must be in the wrong jobs.
Yes.
But are there other? This is a topic that people around the world are very interested in.
Yes. There are some other issues. Like for example, there were some people who were looking for jobs, and for example, you are a college graduate and you're looking for a job. And there's no opening, but maybe the offices or we have this job for just an office assistant.
Mm.
You say, well, I'm looking for a job, whether it's office assistant or what, I need it. And he forgot about his degree and he accepted the job.
Mm.
Now, what we are doing now is to, once we know that you are a college graduate and you are being underpaid because of that situation, will bring you to the level that you're supposed to be and give you a correct salary, give you a better responsibility to function properly.
Do you have any other advice on kind of the patronage problem and dealing with people who have outsized salaries or don't have the training they need?
Yes. Those who were brought into the system in the manner that I talked about earlier, and if we found out that they are not, as I said, if they are not trained, we try to train them, If they are not qualified, we send them to maybe RPA for training or so. And those who were brought in and maybe they reached the age of 60, they were already maybe 60 or so, and they were nearing retirement, and they was brought in. We try to pay them off or maybe pension them. Those are the kind of steps that we've been taking.
Yeah, that's very interesting. On another, we spoke a little bit about decentralization.
Yeah.
In a lot of places, leaders in the capital are worried about the power of local leaders.
Yeah.
But yet you're trying to deliver services into these rural areas.
Yeah.
Do you have any advice on sort of balancing those concerns in the context of your work here?
Well, I've not seen the local leaders, or I've not seen those in the capital being afraid of the local leaders or so. No, that is not the case here.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the case here in Liberia.
So you'd say there's a good relationship.
Yes, there's a very good relationship.
Yeah.
For the rural areas, what we have started doing now is we have established a rural outreach program where we want our presence to be felt in the rural area. Instead of those that want to be employed coming to Monrovia to us, we go there and administer examinations to those who are qualified, and we try to employ them. That's the kind of thing that we're trying to do. We're opening our offices in the counties.
Mm-hmm.
We've identified our regional offices, five regions, and since the budget has passed now, we're going to be opening our offices in the counties where employees in government, civil servants, can relate to us directly in the offices.
Mm.
Those that have special problems or special cases can be addressed at that level.
Right. We've heard a little bit. We have some people who are in Indonesia this summer who have been talking about this issue of sort of buying and selling civil service posts, that you pay off someone to get into a different post, and so people are moving around a lot. Is that something that happens or happened in the transitional government?
No, that is not. No, no, it's not.
Not a problem.
No,
not
no,
a problem.
No.
Okay. I just have a couple of more final questions. I know we're
right.
Almost through.
Okay.
Reflecting on your own background and your sort of personal management style, do you think either your background or drawing on your personal style, are there aspects of that might have helped you make more progress here at where others have failed?
Well, yes. My background has been in the teaching field. I went to teachers' college, and I served as classroom teacher in the past, and I also served as a principal of a high school prior to entering the civil service, and that. Dealing with people, serving as principal, dealing with teachers and students, and helping to solve student problems and teachers and so on and so forth, has helped me to help to manage what we are doing, help to also supervise the work here internally.
Yeah. Some people have pointed to the need for the reform team to articulate a vision for the plan and a plan for the reforms. How important has it been to have this strategic plan that you've written, and how do you use that on a sort of a day-to-day basis to guide people forward?
Yes, for we've been having workshops. We call, like for example, last week Friday we had a workshop with the personnel directors and human resource officers of ministries and agencies of government. to sort of letting know how far we are going and what we are doing, how they too are supposed to perform in line with the reform, and what we expect them to do in terms of the reform. What are the challenges that are ahead of the reform? Like, for example, when a ministry or an agency, if the function of a ministry or an agency is being reviewed, and in a ministry takes on a new function, there will be some challenges. There may be a need, maybe, to reduce the staffing of that ministry, depending on the new role that it has to play. The question will be, what happens to those who are working there? If you have to reduce the staff, what happens? How can you deal with such an issue? There will be a need for counseling. There may be a need for redirection. There will be a need for retraining of some staff to take on new role, and all these are issues that they need to know. And so, to answer your question, we have regular workshops and meetings and so on and so forth for ministries and agencies of government, especially those that are dealing with the reform issue. And as I said earlier, we've established internal reform committee at ministries and agencies of government. If you go to Ministry of Education, for example, you see that there's an internal reform committee functioning, headed by the minister. And this is how we get to them.
Okay, great. One problem I think many leaders face is where to turn for information and advice as they're preparing these reform plans. Where do you turn for advice and information?
For us?
Yeah.
Well, here we are to talk about turning, where to turn. I think ministries and agencies turn to us. But the work that we do is a collaborative work among three institutions. We have the Governance Commission, which has a bigger umbrella or bigger picture of the reform. The Governance Commission is responsible for the land reform, is responsible for judicial reform, is also responsible for other reform programs. In our reform, we are responsible for civil service reform, of course, but we filter into the work of the governance reform. Besides that, we collaborate with the Liberian Institute of Public Administration, and they are responsible for training, but we collaborate and get advice and meet, and we do those type of thing together. That's how it works.
Yeah. Our program, just as a final question, our program helps leaders share their experiences and innovations in addressing challenges that arise in rebuilding states. And we're always sort of on the lookout for items that we should include in the resource that we're building. Do you have anything that we missed here in this conversation, or anything you'd like to add?
It depends on the environment. It depends on the society. For us in Liberia is unique. It's a totally unique issue that you may easily address here without problem, cannot be addressed like that in other countries, depending on their environment. Take for example, in Liberia, the government took over the civil service that government were owing 18 months. And we still have that backlog that has not been addressed. The government has been paying, but that is not clear totally. In this July, government will be paying the regular pay, and will also pay 1 month back pay. in some countries, maybe based on our environment, that can easily be done, where government owes and the government maybe speaks to the employees and they just accept it and they go on easily. That is an issue. Here in Liberia, for example, we have our social security. Like in other countries, when we talk about social security, if you're out of job, if you make contribution to social security and you're out of job, we read from books, from magazines and newspapers that a social security is supposed to, one who is out of job, for example, so to get some sort of support or benefit from the social security. But if here, for example, if you are dismissed or so, that aspect is not working. Where if a person who made contribution before is dismissed, the social security cannot give you a benefit. That's a different scenario altogether. So to address your question, I would say that it depends on the environment. What can be done here easily may not be applicable to other countries. So for us here, there are some issues here that have to do with some cultural backgrounds which are not applicable to other countries. So that has it.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much. This has been a very helpful interview. I appreciate your time very much.
I thank you too.
Thank you
Thank you
very
for coming.
much.
Yes.